Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Welcome to Slate's I Have to Ask. I'm Isaac Chotiner. My guest today is Michelle Dean, a journalist and critic and the author of the new book Sharp, The Women Who Made an Art of Having an Opinion. Sharp examines the lives of 10 women of the 20th century. Susan Sontag, Pauline Kael, Dorothy Parker, Joan Didion, Nora Ephron, Renata Adler, I can't speak, Rebecca West, Hannah Arendt, Mary McCarthy, and Janet Malcolm, and focuses on the impact they made on American culture, politics, and journalism. The book functions as both a history of 20th century intellectual life through the distinct prisms of the book's subjects, and also raises questions about the way society views women in public life then and today. Michelle Dean joins me from Los Angeles, where I guess she is based. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
Thanks for being here.
No problem. I'm happy to be here.
Well, so I wanted to talk about your book, which I just finished. And the first question I had for you is, 10 subjects is a lot for a book. You often see these group biographies. They're about two or three people, sometimes four, maybe even five. But this is about 10. What made you want to do a biography with 10 people and sort of group them together in this way?
Well, the first reason is probably naivete about how much this is my first book. And I think I sort of bit off a large ambitious chunk and then realized like, oh, I picked 10 people. That's a lot. But also because, you know, part of the point of the book is to demonstrate that there's this sort of heritage of this kind of woman critic slash journalist in the American literary tradition. And in order to demonstrate that, it's true that if it was just one, two, or three people, it wouldn't be much of a tradition. It would be like a commonality. And in order to say that it was something stronger than that, like a sort of type that came down all the way through the 20th century, then I really kind of needed 10 people. And there are actually more people who could have been in the book who sort of got dropped. But yeah.
You write in the book early on at one point, I'll just read you what you wrote. These women were all oppositional spirits and they tended not to like being grouped together. So it seems like the book is sort of in some ways a challenge to that since sort of by definition you are grouping them together.
Yes. I mean, so first of all, I am grouping them together, and it did sometimes occur to me that I could end up haunted by some ghosts here of people who were very angry with me for having done it. Yes.
That's what I was hinting at, yeah.
Yeah, there is a danger always of flattening individuality when you write the kind of book like this, which tries to make a series of claims about somebody's writing. And in particular, I'm going through most of these women's whole careers in which they sometimes contradicted themselves, particularly on the subject of their commonality as women writers or their relationship to feminism generally, which would have made like a greater claim on them as sort of representative of their sex rather than simply writers with individual voices. Yeah, I mean, you know, it was a tension that I worried about, and it is a tension that kind of drives the book, in that I feel like the book is elucidating a paradox that even as these women were constantly resisting the idea that they were, you know, women writers first in some way, or that they shouldn't be identified as such, they still managed to sort of carve out a place for a particular kind of woman in public life that ended up being extremely valuable. And I kind of hate this word mostly because it's become jargon now because it's a buzzword, but somewhat empowering for other women to see them engaging at such a high level. And that had this sort of paradoxical feminist effect, even as some of these women would have denied very heavily that they were feminists.
Yeah, I want to talk more about feminism, but first, for people who haven't read the book, can you talk about a little bit what you mean by sharp or sharpness, which is a quality that you keep coming back to in the book, and you kind of unite the women under this rubric, if that's the word I'm looking for. What exactly do you mean by sharpness?
Well, I mean a number of things. Primarily, I do mean a certain kind of writing style or effect of these women's writing, in that it was seen often as exceptionally insightful or sort of cutting through nonsense, or in some way saying something that hadn't been said before. But on the other hand, it was also kind of seen as, for lack of a better word, mean and cutting, to elaborate the sharp metaphor a little bit. And I can get too elaborating of the metaphor in places, but the idea is sort of that it is both a style and an effect of that is attributed to women in public life, that you have these moments both of extraordinary insight and then of extraordinary pushback, because the way that people relate to women with, say, a strong opinion or a strong position on something, the way that society relates to them, as we learn over and over again, it seems, in the course of American history, it's tricky. The women both get venerated for it and then also torn down for their powers of sharpness, so to speak.
So the book kind of goes from early on in the 20th century to the end of the 20th century. And I guess it starts with Dorothy Parker and then Janet Malcolm, I think, is the last one.
Yeah.
I guess what I'm wondering is, how do you think sharpness changed, or our idea of sharpness, especially coming from a woman, changed between, say, 1930 and 2000?
Well, yeah. I mean, I stop the book once we get to third wave feminism, because it seems to me like that third wave feminism arrived in a different cultural context than these women had been writing in. And this notion of the exceptional woman, who was the only woman who was going to be allowed at the table of intellectualism or journalism or criticism, whatever you want to call it, sort of started to recede in the 1990s. And you started to have a lot more women public intellectuals and a lot more women speakers, and a lot less of this attribution of exceptionalism to women who managed to do this. But I don't know that sharpness changed exactly, in part because I think it's, you know, it's sort of like a multiplicitous phenomenon. Sometimes it worked very well for these women, sometimes they were praised for it, and sometimes they weren't. And that goes for everyone from Parker all the way through Malcolm. I'm not sure that it evolved much, but I do think that we got more and more used to this figure in public life of this woman who happened to be very cutting, but also very insightful. And that, yes, by the time we get to the end of the 20th century, this is an archetype that the culture is quite a bit more comfortable with.
So can you talk a little bit about Dorothy Parker, especially for people who haven't read much about her, and why you wanted to start the book with her, what it was about her that felt like a good jumping off point?
Well, you know, she was obviously very caustic, but also very smart. And it's interesting because her literary reputation keeps changing and evolving. Even when she was alive, the same thing happened. At first, she was greeted as brilliant, and then she was greeted as not as brilliant as she should have been and not living up to her potential. And it sort of went back and forth her whole life. I think Dorothy Parker did sort of inaugurate the type for whatever reason. And well, it's not even for whatever reason. In the 1920s, writers became celebrities in a way that they almost never would be again in 20th century culture. And she happened to be the woman, or one of the main women, who was elevated by that phenomenon. And it's funny because she was such a... She tended to write so directly and so... Again, at the risk of being totally obsessed with my own metaphor, cuttingly, that people couldn't ignore what she had to say. Even though, you know, sometimes, and there is a certain set of literary criticism that maintains that Parker was mostly focusing on trivialities. I don't really agree with that. But even when she spoke on trivialities, they ended up being things that we ended up remembering.
It feels like some people, sort of one critique of Parker that people make, that sort of there was something frivolous about her, that she was not writing, as you say, on serious subjects. Is that something that you think that the women that you're writing about, and even women writing today, are aware is thrown at them more frequently than at men who are writing? And how much were the people in the book conscious of the fact that that was a critique that people made of women writers?
I think they all knew it. I mean, I think it was inescapable, basically. It's been an inescapable phenomenon even now. It feels like things are opening up now a little bit for it. But yeah, even, you know, so Rebecca West also would write sometimes about how you know, how frustrating it was that, like, women didn't get to speak exactly to their own sexual preferences in most of the literature of the day, where meanwhile, like, somebody like H.G. Wells is just spreading, as she once called it, his cold clotted cream type sexuality all over his novels. And then, you know, even somebody like Mary McCarthy, who is one of the people in the book who is more resistant to calling herself a feminist or whatever, you know, she wrote in an introduction to her theater criticism about how she always felt she never sort of set out to become a theater critic for Partisan Review, but she, you know, she knew that when they gave her that post at Partisan Review, they did it largely because they saw her, meaning the editors. They saw her as basically another editor's girlfriend, and they thought of the theater as not a very important subject. And so they could just give it to her to do without much risk to the integrity of the institution or what have you, or the seriousness of Partisan Review. So I think they all knew it in one way or another. I mean, even Hannah Arendt recently, I think she sort of knew, although she tended to buy a little more the idea that some things were serious and not serious. Although actually, I think all the women writers in the book also bought that dichotomy at one point or another.
The one person in your book that I think if people just reading the list of names might be somewhat surprised to see in there is Nora Ephron, who I think a lot of people think as a very brilliant humorist and screenwriter above all else, or at least in sort of the popular conception. Why did you want to include her, and how do you think she fits in with the group?
Actually, Nora was kind of, in many ways, the seed of the book, in that I, too, thought of her that way as mostly a humorist and a film director of, and please forgive me, of not necessarily always very good romantic comedies.
No, come on.
You know, I should say here that, like, I'm Canadian and I grew up there and my cultural touchstones are different. So I don't even think I was very aware that she had written any journalism at all until a couple of years before she died. Somebody gave me a copy of one of her first books, which is called Crazy Salad. And I read it, and it was sort of a revelation to me, because I found, frankly, Nora's writing very serious, at the risk of reinforcing the dichotomy we were just talking about. I mean, her approach was very much kind of intellectual, which again is not something that I had associated her with prior to that. And that exactly that revelation made me wonder, like, what else am I missing about the history of women writers in the 20th century? Like, I had no idea that she had been something of a celebrity journalist in her time. And it seemed to me that that aspect of her had sort of been buried behind this focus on her, the sort of trivialities of her later work, or what were seen as the trivialities of her later work. She really kind of belongs in the book, though, because in many ways she was an heir to Parker, sort of, you know, Parker refigured through a Hollywood childhood and second wave feminism, but still, you know, very much writing in the same vein and in the same sort of caustic tone.
We'll get back to my conversation with Michelle Dean right after this. After having now finished the book and read all 10 of these women, I assume, spent a lot of time reading all 10 of these women, were there any that they're writing that you feel has aged particularly well or has not aged particularly well? Did your opinion of any of them as writers kind of go up or down in a way that was different than you expected going in, and why?
You know, I tend to be more of like a biographical critic, and mostly because actually my temperament is of a historian and journalist and not so much of a critic. So for me, I wasn't usually reading them to evaluate them. It's funny, though, because so Mary McCarthy, for example, who was more famous in her own day, but is probably now only remembered for her fight with Lillian Hellman about what a liar Lillian Hellman was, which I can now say without worrying that Lillian Hellman will sue me for defamation. But Mary McCarthy had a revival a few years ago, and mostly because actually the group showed up on Mad Men. Betty's reading it in the bath at some point. And people started to get interested in the group again, which is a novel for those of your readers who don't know. It's published in 1963 about a group of women sort of coming of age in New York in the 1930s. And it sort of inaugurated, I mean, it didn't totally inaugurate, actually, the history of, like, young women coming to the city and it becoming, like, a storied thing goes back to some books, a book called My Sister Eileen, that was actually written in the 1930s, or published in the 1920s, sorry. Whoops. But yeah, the group was an interesting historical phenomenon because it was a very sexually frank book. And it was published in 1963, which was as, you know, the second wave of feminism was starting to gear up, at least at the intellectual end, if not the activist end. So there was this enormous response to that book. But if I was going to answer the question, what is Mary McCarthy's best book? I would never say The Group. I would say it was The Company She Keeps, which is the book she published earlier of short stories about also a young woman coming to the city and mixing among intellectuals and having ambivalent sexual experiences a la Cat Person, that I really wish more people read that book. For me, all of as a historian or as somebody trying to put together this history of these women's writing and the reception to their work, there's always like something interesting about every text. And it left me not judging them solely as is this good or is this bad.
You glancingly mentioned when we started about these women's relationship to feminism. And at the end of the book, you write, all through this book, I have been trying to point out that there is room in this deep ambivalence about and even hostility towards feminism to take away a feminist message. What did interest me going through the book person by person is this ambivalence that many of them felt towards what we define as feminism. And I'm wondering if you could talk about, to speak of them as a group, what, and you can mention individuals too, where you think this comes from and why it was so potent.
Well, so first of all, when I say feminism in this connection, I mostly mean movement feminism, so defining it down a little bit in that, now that we live in an era of widespread cultural feminism or pop cultural feminism, we don't tend to think of it as like a formal movement in the same way. And it looked a little bit more formal in these women's times. Like there were people who went to feminist meetings, you know, and wore feminist buttons in a way that they don't typically do right now. I think that in general, the ambivalence towards feminism is the ambivalence that anybody, any writer, or as I try to politely put it, oppositional spirit would feel towards social movements, in that there's always a kind of flattening of self that is involved in engaging in political action. And I don't mean that the flattening is permanent. I don't mean that people go into social movements and become zombies, but I mean that to a certain extent, to use a contemporary example, there are days when you just have to put the pussy hat on, even if you don't like the aesthetics of the pussy hat in a movement. That's just the way that social movements work. But the activity of writing or speaking in public or being yourself in public is naturally sort of opposed to that, because it might be hard for somebody like one of these women, and was often hard for somebody like these women, to make a crack about the pussy hats of their day and what might bother them about them. It was hard for them to not be forthcoming about that. And so I say ambivalence because actually, although I am charting women who mostly did not explicitly align themselves with feminism, or to the extent that they did often express like frustration or ambivalence about how the movement was shaping up, most of them came around eventually. I mean, Didion is famous for having written a sort of takedown of the movement, which was sort of in the form of a book review of a bunch of different feminist books of the early 1970s. But even she, you know, in an interview not so very long ago, told an interviewer, you know, like, I was documenting a specific moment in time where I felt like that the movement was getting caught up in trivialities about like who should wash dishes and stuff. And I'm not sure the movement is there anymore. And I don't think I would say the same thing about it. Or Mary McCarthy, who, you know, would do things at the end of her life, like give a speech where she'd say, I'm not a feminist in one breath, and then later say, you know, I guess I'm enough of a feminist to have never liked it when people told me that I wrote like a man.
Mm, right.
So I think there was not necessarily hostility to the idea that in the world there are gendered structures of knowledge and power. I mean, I even found like sort of popped up on the internet, and I had read it or encountered it before, but just hadn't really thought about it too hard. But it popped up in the internet as a meme lately, this thing where Hannah Arendt is giving an interview towards the end of her life. And she says, you ask me what kind of influence I wish I have. And, you know, if I'm going to speak ironically, I just want to say, I think that's a very masculine question. Men are always looking at influence, and I'm looking to understand. And I think it's interesting that she said that, right? In spite of the fact that she was definitely the person most hostile to feminism, sort of in the book.
Yeah, I think the way you phrase it in the book, I don't want to get this wrong, but you say it's about sisterhood and they were individuals.
Yeah.
You've read these women a lot more than I have, but I have the vivid memory of reading Black Lamb and Grey Falcon, which is Rebecca West's kind of incredible travelogue through the Balkans between the two world wars. And it's a sort of amazing dichotomy, which I think you capture in the book about a lot of these women, which is that this kind of incredible, this incredibly strong personality and this belief that, you know, women should be equal and sort of the goals of feminism, but also just constant cracks about women, about the way they look, referring to them by names that we would now deem politically incorrect for good reason, and sort of taking shots at kind of the official women's movement of the day. And sort of that dichotomy, which goes through a 1,000-page book, is pretty striking. And it's a very interesting kind of approach that these women had, or several of them had.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because, you know, like if I was talking purely in political theory, like I don't want to sound like I'm a total celebration of the individual, but you read a book like Black Lamb and Grey Falcon and you think there is some value to this individual sensibility. I do think West could sometimes be really hard on people's appearances. Like, she tended to be that way overall, whether she was talking about women or men, frankly. On their personal appearances, she tended to extrapolate a lot from, say, the shape of their nose. although it's kind of fun to just watch her mind sort of ramble over these things. And there is something, actually, this kind of sort of self-awareness or having a little bit of fun at the expense of your politics is somehow also politically valuable in a way I feel like I keep struggling to articulate in these interviews, that, you know, feminism would be richer or will be richer if it becomes something more of like a Tower of Babel, right? Where everybody is arguing all the time. I would prefer if the arguments were of, you know, relative good nature to what they are right now. But there's something valuable in having all these individual sensibilities crop up and sort of amount to feminism in the aggregate, as opposed to just sort of rehearsing rote arguments about, I don't know, about liberation and equality, which are useful, but I think, which I think are actually easier to come to in the process of us all arguing together.
It struck me a little bit that what you were saying mirrored, in certain ways, maybe you disagree with this, the way some feminists of kind of, you know, my parents and baby boomer generation have been talking about feminism as they perceive it on social media these days, which they view, again, I'm speaking broadly, as kind of flattening, and that they're not these sort of everyone throwing their opinion in the ring and sort of a flattening of opinion and voices. Do you think that that's, do you see any similarity there? And what have you thought of that critique generally?
Well, I actually think that critique tends to come from people who don't like engage on social media with feminists. And because I think that in general, I mean, I don't want to talk too much about Katie Royfe exactly, but if you read like a piece like that, which is representative, I think, of some of what you're talking about, where she's trying to characterize the Me Too movement, it seemed to me very obvious that she, from the piece, not knowing anything necessarily about her, that she had not engaged a lot on social media, because there was an idea that on social media there is a party line about feminism that is being observed. And in my experience, that is not totally the case. Do I think that social media discussion about feminism is flattening, though? I do, but I think it's more about the way that social media has completely poisoned our conversational dynamics in society generally, and it is not a problem specific to feminism. I mean, I think that online feminism has in many ways been great, or was great, and I come out of it in some sense. I mean, I'm a person who came to writing and journalism late, and I came to it actually through the feminist comments sections, among other places. And those were extremely vibrant conversational places. And I think that there is still some of that going on online. And I think, yeah, I do think, as somebody who engages a lot on social media, I tweet way too much. I do think it poisons conversational dynamics, but I sort of get frustrated when people think it's about feminism going too far. It's about feminism getting caught in a net that everything's getting caught in right now.
When you were researching this book and seeing the way that men and society at large responded to these women, putting their opinions out there in the world. How do you think that's changed now for female journalists and novelists and writers in the current era? And what's your experience been with that?
There are things that are better, but like there are more women speaking than ever before. And I think to a certain extent, we have to acknowledge that. We have to acknowledge that women are getting a greater foothold in the public sphere than they've ever had before. And that's very exciting. And it's great. And it's great that we live in an era where it's possible to discuss these things or like, you know, problems like representation or the inability of this country to elect a woman as president. It's great to live in an era where we have those discussions out in the open. But and some of that has been opened up by social media, which was great, which allowed like sort of more voices to get into the conversation. But on the other hand, social media and the activity, being a woman who writes now means being online mostly. And it also means, therefore, that people can reach you more easily to express their dissent. I mean, another seed of this book was actually years ago, I wrote a review for Slate, actually, of a book called How Should a Person Be by Sheila Hetty. I liked the book. It had been the subject of some criticism that I thought did not get the book. And the book... one of the conceits of the review was that serious men did not seem to understand it, because there were a lot of male literary critics who wrote about it who seemed to think it was, to me, they just misread the book, not to get too far into the weeds. But I've received some of the only hate mail I've ever received as a journalist about that book review, about a literary book, in that it just seemed to anger a lot of men. And I was getting a lot of emails from people. I remember one of them specifically saying, like, I think this review is stupid. And by the way, my girlfriend thinks so too. And getting responses like that is pretty much a commonality of being a woman speaking in public now. They can just get at you so much easier. You can't hide. You can't get away from them. And that makes it really frustrating and chaotic to be a woman who speaks in public. And I'm not sure that we really have figured out how to navigate that yet. I mean, we sometimes talk about it under the rubric of harassment, and some of it is harassment. But there's also just like a level of it that is so much more low-lying noise and frustration with women who actually say things, or even just the sound of your voice. I mean, I've gotten that several times, that men listen to the sound of my voice somewhere on a podcast or on TV or whatever, and I get emails of women too. And that was common for the women of these eras, but they didn't have to deal with quite so much pushback. That struck me very strongly.
Do you think there's more, I mean, putting aside kind of the people who are harassing or, you know, people who are super negative online or something, do you think there's more kind of mainstream acceptance of women expressing strong or sharp opinions and for their own sake?
There is. I mean, we have lots of public figures now we could identify as being in this sort of tradition, or at least being outspoken women in public. Still not enough, I don't think. I mean, there'll be enough when there's been 50% in the public sphere for more than a couple of years. But yeah, there is more widespread acceptance. I mean, Me Too, to the extent that it has been a women-led movement. I mean, there have been men also who have spoken out about their experiences, but it does clear a way. So, like, even aside from the discussion about harassment, there is something about it that says, like, we need to reevaluate the way that we listen or don't listen to women. And having that conversation on the table has been useful, even if it doesn't feel like everybody is adjusting to it.
Michelle Dean is the author of the new book, Sharp, The Women Who Made an Art of Having an Opinion. Michelle, do you think you can name all 10 of these women without looking at a notepad?
Oh, sure. Do you want me to do it?
Yeah, do it for the audience.
Dorothy Parker, Rebecca West, Mary McCarthy, Hannah Arendt, Pauline Kael, Susan Sontag, Joan Didion, Nora Ephron, Janet Malcolm, and Renata Adler.
All right, that was very impressive. The book is available wherever you want to buy books. And Michelle, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for today. I Have to Ask is produced by Max Jacobs. Thanks to Topher Ruth at Northgate Studios in Berkeley. And thanks for the additional help from Erica Moo in Los Angeles. If you have an idea for a guest or you just want to let me know your thoughts, email me at ask@slate.com. That's ASK@slate.com. Or you can follow me at Twitter @iChotner. Thanks for listening.